Welcome to the Riding Unicorns podcast. This is the podcast all about growth startups. I'm James Pringle. I'm a technology founder, investor, and VC at Portfolio Ventures. My co-host is Hector Mason. Hector is a partner at B2B Investor Episode 1 Ventures. This podcast is all about uncovering what it takes to build a unicorn business.
This week's episode is with Tristan Thomas. Tristan was a key member of the Monzo team as VP of Marketing and is now the founder of Packfleet, which is on a mission to be the best delivery company on earth. In this episode, we cover lessons from scaling Monzo, timing your fundraise, Tristan's thoughts on product managers, and so much more. It's a really great episode with a top operator. Let's get started. Hi, Tristan. Welcome to the Riding Unicorns podcast. It's great to have you on. So, Tristan, maybe we could just start with an intro to Packfleet.
Yeah, sure. Thank you for having me. So Packfleet is a tech-enabled, next-generation, carbon-neutral courier. We've been going about 2 years now, nearly 2 years. Started to think about how do we provide an alternative to the legacy couriers that are out there, both for merchants, retailers, and for end consumers. Too many parcels ended up in my bin and finally got so frustrated with it that we thought there must be a better way to do this. And how do we use technology to make it better? So today we have about 60 electric vans covering all of London and the M25, doing deliveries for a range of businesses, everyone from, you know, tiny beer shops and bakeries all the way up to large clothing retailers. And we offer merchants that platform where they get access to eco-friendly deliveries, as well as a software layer on top to help them understand what is happening with their deliveries and how to improve those.
And Tristan, we're looking forward to getting into the weeds of what you've built and what's to come. But you didn't start your career at Monzo, but you had a successful career at Monzo, which is clearly one of the poster children of the UK startup ecosystem. And so I'd love to dive into that a little bit and, you know, be your take on that scaling journey and your involvement.
Yeah, so I joined Monzo back in 2015. It was tiny at the time. I think I was employee number 12 or 13. And it really was the start of my startup career. Before that, I'd been living and working in Egypt, and I moved back to London basically to get into tech startups. I'd always read Hacker News and done side projects and all of that sort of thing. And so I thought, okay, let me give this a go for real. I applied for a few random startups. Basically, I went on, I think literally it was workinstartups.com, and applied. And one of the interviews I had was with Monzo. And at the time, they were pre-product, so it seemed like a fun idea. I really liked the team, and they were my first interview, and they offered me the job before the others, and I just said yes because I thought, great, I've got a job in startups. And so that was as a community manager originally, so basically running social media and thinking about how do we build a community around a bank, which historically was a very opaque industry that you really didn't get the opportunity to be involved in. I spent the next 5 years there, and we went from 13 employees up to 1,500 employees, from zero customers up to about 4.5 million when I left. And over that time, I did a few different roles, sort of typical startup, was community manager, then moved into product management, building out our first Android app, and then ended up building out and leading our marketing community and policy teams.
I wonder if you would open up about, you know, some of the things that didn't work out, that failed, or, you know, maybe things that projects that you were running that failed, and how do you pick yourselves up from those sorts of things?
Yeah, how long have you got? I think it's really easy to look back at Monzo, especially now, and think, you know, it was an immediate success. And that was definitely not true, especially that first 6 months to a year as we built out the very first version of the product and really spent a bunch of time trying to figure out, like, what do people want and how do we get this out to people? And I ended up being responsible for, like, how do we get this out to people? We basically went and sort of generated a bunch of ideas on what to do. Some of it was like straightforward stuff like Facebook ads. And then we did a bunch of other stuff that didn't work. We used to go with Tom, our CEO, and go into sort of popular startups and go and do like lunch and learns with them and tell them about Monzo. It seemed like a really good idea at the time, like get into like well-connected people. And we did, I don't know, 10, 20 of them, and just total failure. Really, really good for recruiting, very bad for getting people signed up, because you go and you spend, like, you travel there, you spend hours talking to them, giving a talk, and you give out 10 cards, maybe 15 cards. And it took us a while to realize how unhelpful that was. Although, yeah, as I said, very good for recruiting. We did an event outside Old Street Station where we gave out cards and gave out flyers, and the whole company went and did that for a couple of days. I think we got about 12 signups from that. There's like the whole long list on from those early days of things that we tried that just really didn't work. And then, you know, later on, I think we tried many things as a business that I was closely involved in that didn't work. Our first Monzo Plus premium accounts launched and everyone hated them. We lost a lot of money on ATM fees for a long time and finally sort of fixed that by introducing fees. And yeah, as I say, I could go on and on. But I think we always try to be, and I'm always like happy to talk about it because we always try to be open about those failures because I think they're just a sort of rite of passage to some extent.
Yeah, and interviews are often two-way sort of street. On one hand, you're trying to get the job, but you also want to make sure that you're going to work for a company that's exciting. And it was a bit like stock picking to some extent, and you picked a great company to run with. What advice would you have within that process? Because a lot of people dream of joining a company really early and going on that journey. So what advice would you have to someone who's maybe listening, who thinks, yeah, I'm going to go and work for a company with less than 20 employees and ride that journey? How do they identify a business like that? What did they say in your interview that maybe it helped you get excited for the Monzo journey?
Yeah, so, I mean, this is probably one of like, do as I say, not as I do, because I did it because they seemed fun and offered me the job. But since then, I've talked to lots of people with this question. And I think a few things that I ended up doing somewhat accidentally. One was not worrying about what job or what title I was joining for. And I see this all the time as we're hiring now, people who come from another company and really worried about, you know, not getting the one-up title that they expect compared to their old title or not really exact want their job role fully defined. And early stage startup, when you're 10, 20, 30 people, just doesn't matter. Like everyone will have to do everything. And if you are successful, there will be hundreds, if not thousands of jobs available and you will be able to pick any of them because you've been there from the beginning. And so really for people to not worry about that and focus on the company that they're joining. A few things I think are important there. One is that you are genuinely excited about what they're doing. And it's really easy to sort of lose sight of that because you're excited about the possibility of getting a job or they're well funded or they're hyped. But you have to be like genuinely excited about the problem that they're solving. There are many startups out there and many solving problems that, yeah, I personally don't get excited about at all. And that's fine for the first month or two. And after that, you'll lose interest very quickly. And I think the other thing that was really important to us at Monzo and that did attract me was culture. Like, how do you build an open, transparent culture? And does it feel like that is what's being built at the startup? Because the first startup you go to is like the best learning opportunity in the world. And the best way to get that learning is by knowing what's going on across the business and being able to see what's going on. You get that front row seat to a startup building. And if it's not an open and transparent culture, then you won't learn anything.
With the point around not caring about what role you join a startup for, I think it's an interesting discussion because I think people who have great confidence in their career ability and huge self-belief probably won't care too much about what role they join a company in. So to an extent, you sort of can use that as part of your selection criteria. It's like, well, we want to hire really ambitious, confident people, and only those kinds of people are going to not care about role. So we'll just look for people who don't care about role. But the flip side is, you know, do you sacrifice some diversity and do you sacrifice finding some diamonds in the rough who grow into fantastic operators?
Yeah, I think that is true. And I mean, I come from a very privileged background and so had that opportunity and that sort of perspective of being able to do that. I think the key thing is not to block people just because of that. Like if you can describe to people the potential upside, and you know, it doesn't mean that they get it immediately or that they were taught it early on, but if during the interview process you can show them what is that potential, either from existing employees who've sort of scaled the ranks, so to speak, or from other examples at other startups, then I think you want someone who can understand that at least and understand that the potential is there, even if it's not something that they came in understanding or knowing.
And so then, Tristan, where did the idea for Packfleet come from? Was it whilst you were still at Monzo or had you left and sort of started to think about new ideas? And what was the first steps in validating the idea for Packfleet?
Yeah, so it started back in March 2020. I was still at Monzo and we went into lockdown. And I suddenly, for the first time in literally since I joined Monzo, had free time. We weren't allowed to leave in the evenings. I suddenly had all of this time. And so I started playing around with side projects again, which is something I'd done a lot before Monzo and then had no time at all for 5 years. Did a bunch of random stupid side projects to sort of keep myself entertained. And one of them was a wine subscription business. My brother works in wine. And so we basically wanted to build a wine recommendation platform, I guess, for millennials. If you don't know anything about wine, but you want to be able to drink wine, sign up, we'll send you some bottles, you rate them, then we send you more wine that you like. Really a sort of elaborate scheme to get me cheap wine during lockdown. But through that, we ended up working with, you know, the whole wealth of couriers and logistics providers and saw what it was like working with them from the merchant side, from the retailer side. I'd always seen it from the consumer side with, you know, parcels being delivered badly or not at all. But then seeing it from the merchant side was an eye-opener because it was even worse on their side. And that was everything from collections not turning up, not being able to see where a parcel was, like a total lack of customer centricity when problems happened. And I basically spent the time while doing that side project saying, like, why is this so bad? And why has no one tried to fix it? I was still at Monzo, obviously lockdown lifted. And basically that sat in the back of my mind then, like an annoyance, basically, and something that I felt like I would want to solve, but felt like it was quite difficult. And so I sort of kept pushing it away. About 6 or 7 months later, I left Monzo, sort of unrelated to that. Had enough, basically. Had spent 5 years there, was ready to do something new and go back to early stage. Took a few months off and then started playing around again with some of the different ideas I'd had. And Packfleet, what became Packfleet at least, kept bubbling up to the top. And so I thought, let me see if other small businesses, like my wine business, have the same problem. And so I just emailed 5 local businesses, pretending that we were a courier, a new courier that was up and running, that would actually deliver their parcels without damaging them, and asked if they wanted to sign up. And 2 of them replied and said yes, and we would like to, like, how soon can we start? Which was great / slightly terrifying. And so I then spent the next week hacking together a truly terrible, but just about working system for them to upload packages onto. I convinced my brother-in-law who'd moved back home during COVID to come down and live with me in London and go out and do deliveries after his part-time job. So he set off at 2 p.m., went and did a bunch of deliveries. And that's how we got started. It was really like, for the first 3 or 4 months, parcels piled up in my living room. My brother-in-law decided he didn't want to pursue a career delivering parcels for me, but my neighbor was up for it. And so sort of gathered together this like hodgepodge of people and we started delivering. And it was like tiny numbers, 100 parcels a month, something like that.
I love these hacky MVPs. And even before MVP, right, it's the testing customer demand. And what you did is a really solid way to test customer demand. And I think I came across years ago when I was an entrepreneur, this kind of hacky way of testing customer demand, which was to do mock-ups of a product and run like digital ads with those mock-ups and see what kind of CPA and all that you get.
Yeah.
And I just think like that is a proper proxy for customer demand rather than a survey and sort of hypothetical questions. You want to actually go out there and see if people will truly buy something when you offer it to them. And so, yeah, I really like that approach.
Yeah. And it's, yeah, easier than ever now. Like I can't code. Well, I can code a little bit of HTML and CSS very badly, but you can now build with no code tools. Like I built the first version of Packfleet using Bubble, which is just a drag and drop no code tool that connected into people's Shopify account, let them upload CSVs, like all of this stuff. And that and a combination of 3 or 4 random SaaS tools was enough to say, hey, we can deliver a few hundred parcels this month.
Yeah. And how did you get comfortable with the market? Like, I mean, you've kind of hinted that you knew that this was a biggie and this was going to be pretty tricky. And so you pushed it out as far as you could. But it's like, you know, it's a low margin business, huge players, huge incumbents, and you need economies of scale to get your cost of delivery down and all of these, yeah, all of these challenges. So it makes it really hard for a startup to come in and disrupt without a huge war chest of funding. So what kind of got you comfortable with actually starting this?
I'm not sure I ever got comfortable, honestly. I think, I mean, set semi-comfortable now. I think really it was that I was just trying these things and this started to take off. And once I'd started, I then had a few businesses that were relying on me for their deliveries and sort of couldn't stop. And I think two other things, I guess, helped. One was that, rightly or wrongly, I saw a lot of similarities between Monzo going up against large-scale traditional banks and us going up against large-scale traditional couriers. Huge differences, but conceptually, I think come away from Monzo with this arrogance, that this belief that we could do anything, that you could tackle any market, and that actually not knowing anything about a market was hugely beneficial. And so I think I had that to sort of, yeah, not necessarily get me comfortable, but give me that arrogance slash confidence to push forward. And then on top of that, just seeing how bad the technology was made me believe that with technology, you could make it better. It's like this, not necessarily based in like logic step by step, but this belief that we could use technology to improve all of those things that you just talked about, to improve margins, to reduce costs, to make it an interesting and viable business.
In a way, it's simple, right? It's like, this is clearly an opportunity. There is clearly a way to do this better. You're not reinventing the wheel. You're just making a wheel much rounder so that it rolls better. And anyone can see that there are all sorts of inefficiencies. All you had to do, I guess, is believe that you could get to the point where basically the margins made sense. And you had to get investors to believe in that as well.
Yeah, exactly that. I think I'm like very attracted to businesses like this, where you're taking what is a very traditional market and just doing it much better. And I think you then unlock a bunch of opportunity on top of that doesn't exist in the existing markets. But to start with, you're just, as you say, making the wheel rounder. And in some ways, while there are a bunch of challenges, it's often easier to do that because, you know, when you think about what does product market fit look like, you've already got examples. You've got these terrible companies that have product market fit and you understand their business model and consumers are already, or businesses are already educated on it. You're not trying to educate people from the beginning. And so while you have a bunch of extra challenges, you also have huge benefits over coming and doing something that's sort of totally new to the market.
Yeah, absolutely. And Tristan, you had a hacky version, you had a couple of early customers. At what point did you decide, I'm ready for investment, or I've got something here which I can put together a viable story to take to investors? Yeah, where's that inflection point?
Yeah, so I came away from Monzo for the first month or two after I'd finished saying, I will never work for another VC-funded business again, and definitely not start one. And part of that was just sort of pushback against, you know, a very stressful 5 years. And that mellowed over a few months of space and time. And with Packfleet, I got to this point, I guess 2 points. One was it was starting to cost me quite a lot of money and I didn't have much money. You know, I was paying my neighbor and my brother-in-law to deliver these parcels. We definitely didn't have the economies of scale yet. My brother-in-law also crashed the rental car that I got him. So it was starting to get quite expensive. And the second was that I think that the VC is, there are some businesses that are perfectly suited to raising investment. And those are businesses like banks that have a high upfront capital cost. And I see many businesses raising VC that I don't think need to. But looking at Packfleet, it was very clear to me that it was a business that needed to raise investment. And that combined with, you know, we were starting to see good signs of adoption and a huge market made it seem like this was worth exploring.
It's kind of a simple investment case, right, for an investor, because it goes back to improving an old industry. And for a business like Packfleet, the investor can call up customers and all the customers are going to say, well, if Packfleet can do this, of course we'll use them. That'd be absolutely brilliant. And so the investor's decision then comes down to, which horse shall we back? You know, do we back this team to be the one that's going to win and build a successful company? So I wonder if, is that kind of what you heard in your investor meetings, or what kind of questions did they throw at you?
Yeah, I mean, basically that. So our pre-seed investment, which we raised in sort of June or July of that year, so 3 or 4 months in, it was just me at the time and was like really based upon that. Like, we believe that Tristan can pull together a team of people and tackle this problem. There was, from the investor's point of view, there was obviously some analysis of the market and the idea, but like a pre-seed, you know, there's only so far you can go. So is it large market? Is there a problem here? Both of those are clearly yes. And does it feel like this team will get to something good here? And that was the basis for the pre-seed investment that we raised. For our seed round, which was about a year ago, so sort of spring 2022.
Big was the seed raise?
So pre-seed was $1 million and seed was $8 million.
Right.
And seed was obviously still about team, but also much more about, okay, where is this business going and what does it look like? And everything you said is right from a sort of investor point of view, but specifically for VCs, you need to be showing how you're going to build a very large scale, high margin business. And that will become the thing that I think we'll focus on more and more in future funding rounds. You sort of have that transition from team to like, is the product right there and the service to actually, what does this look like long term?
How much of the Monzo playbook have you been able to bring into Packfleet? I mean, that, you know, from the outside, it looks like a customer centric business and there are hints of similar design. And, you know, so there's some pretty superficial stuff in terms of growth and product mentality, all of that stuff. What learnings have you had from Monzo?
Yeah, it's really interesting. Like we've done a lot of things similarly, definitely from a design point of view. As you said, Hugo, my co-founder, designed Monzo's Hot Coral Card and designs Packfleet's, I don't know what we're calling them, hot aquamarine vans. But I think especially from a product point of view, thinking about how do we build for both merchants and end consumers a product that really feels magical to use, that feels as good as, you know, using Deliveroo or Monzo. I think that is a huge part of everything we do. And brand generally is very important to us. But we're a B2B business at our core, at least for now. And that's involved building out whole areas and skills that I knew nothing about, sales being the primary one. I thought, having run marketing at Monzo, I was like, oh, sales can't be that different. And have discovered over the last 12 months or so how different sales is, how difficult it is hiring salespeople and building out sales processes. And so from that point of view, it's very different. It's like a whole different world.
Yeah. And on like, when you're thinking about customer problems and where the areas where your customers suffer, how do you prioritize what to build? Because I guess you can use technology to make this more efficient. And I'm sure there are some other clever things that you're doing, which hopefully we can talk about to kind of make things more efficient and make the experience for everyone better. But there's an inevitable tension in logistics between price and quality of service at some level. So how do you decide where to focus your energy? I mean, maybe it depends on type of customer, or I don't know what it depends on.
Yeah, my answer to this changes every 3 or 4 months broadly. And we're still at the size where up until the beginning of this year, we could only focus on one thing at a time as a business. And so last year was very much focused on growth. How do we unlock growth and what does that look like? And so prioritization was based around that. What helps us unlock larger merchants and what helps us offer an experience to them and to their customers that sets us above all of our competitors. We're now just about at sort of 25 people. We now have the ability to focus on a couple of different things at the same time. Still one thing as a company, but we're able to sort of attack that from different angles. Right now, we're very focused on sort of revenue and costs and thinking about how we do that. But always from a product point of view, because all of these things feed into it. We really do not want to go out and build a slightly better career, like a slightly rounder wheel. We need to build a much rounder wheel and then like the car on top of it. Or I don't know.
How round can a wheel get? I mean,
be stretched too far. But, you know, build a hovercraft instead of the wheel and build something that goes beyond just being a better career. And so that's like the North Star. And then everything needs to flow down from that. And always with a product mindset, like, what do our customers want? And that kind of two-sided sometimes, like, what do our merchants want who are paying customers and what do their customers want who are the users a lot of the time?
What is the hovercraft? What is the car on top? Like, what are the things you're excited about in the medium and long term?
In the same way that you can land in any major city across the world and open Uber and get a car, you should be able to open Packfleet and move something physical from A to B. That's where we want to get to. We're a long way away from that today. But long term, making that as easy as getting your Uber is the dream. And everything that flows down from that, both for businesses, for consumers, to consumer, like unlocking everything across borders as well, is the long-term plan. That's the hovercraft.
Justin, have you hired product managers yet?
No, I hate product managers. Very few product managers are good. I've worked with some excellent product managers, but I can count them on one hand, like literally 3 or 4 probably out of like more than 40 or 50. Yeah, it's very hard to get good product managers because like a great product manager, A, has like innate product sense, which is surprisingly missing in many product managers. And so product managers who don't have it will go out and A/B test all day and spend a bunch of time researching and like all of this stuff for things that are very obvious for people with product sense. And they then need the ability to like bring together a bunch of competing priorities and prioritize them effectively and get everyone on board and do all of that. And lots of people think they're good at it. Very few people are actually good at it. So we are holding off hiring product managers for as long as we can. At some point, they become necessary. Like, you need someone in that role, whether you call them a product manager or not, who, at least my view of them, is like, who holds that coordination point of view, who holds the decision making in the end on what we're building. And when we come to it, we will try and hire those three or four great product managers that I've worked with.
Yeah, because sorry, you go, Jay. I'm just doubling down on that a little bit, because I think there's quite a lot of talk about like founder-led sales, because you need to like talk to the customer and everything. But presumably the same goes for like founder-led product at the beginning. You know, the founder's got the true vision of what they're trying to build, the hovercraft maybe. And a product manager can kind of come in and create a lot of inaction, a lot of overthinking or just like distraction around the product. Is that kind of how you feel about it?
Yeah, but even more than founder-led product, I think is that often by hiring a product manager, you take away agency from everyone else who's involved in that. That's especially true from engineers and designers. And so I want to hire like product-led engineers and product-led designers. We're very lucky at Packfleet that our engineering team is all experienced, senior, very strong product engineering focus. And that gives us that ability to sort of say, okay, we're not going to hire product managers, because engineers can go and do everything that a product manager does, go and do the research, go and do the testing, go and figure out what customers need. And that the closer we can bring the people building the product to users, the better. And product managers often one extra layer there.
I think this is such an interesting conversation, and I'm going to pitch a thought that came into my head, and Tristan, you can tell me whether it's right or wrong, and it's probably too reductive, but the way you've talked about it, I'm kind of thinking now of many product managers kind of being better ops people, and actually the really good product managers are entrepreneurs. And so you need to find the people who are creative and operators who can be those product managers, and they're quite few and far between, probably because they're often entrepreneurs.
Yep. Yeah, I 100% agree with that. Like, there's always a lot of controversy over, like, is a product manager the CEO of the product? And I think we probably get lost in that debate. But I think what you're saying is right. The best product managers have that combination of knowing what customers want and, like, frankly, will push through anything to get it done, often pissing off a lot of people around them. And bad product managers will keep everyone happy around them. And in the end, you can see what the output is, right? And the outcomes. And I think that's what you need to focus on.
Honestly, I think that's a great insight. And I think people listening who are hiring product managers should think about that. And if you're a product manager listening, be more entrepreneurial.
There are some great product managers. Before I annoy everyone.
Also, it's just also interesting timing, I think, because I think even a few years ago, there wasn't even a role called a product manager in Europe. It's kind of a US thing, and the training around it hasn't been particularly good. So there are maybe only a handful in the market that have actually been good at it and been successful at it and would then be a good hire. And maybe there needs to be more product coaching for founders rather than hiring product managers. Is that a fair statement?
I just don't think you can teach it. Like, maybe this is the like most extremist view, and or at least teach it in a course or like training. It's like, to your point, Hector, it's like saying, can you teach someone to be an entrepreneur? And I just don't think you can. The way you can do it, though, is like people learning and being embedded in strong product companies and seeing it over time and all of that sort of thing. And some of the best product managers I've seen did that. They, you know, came in at customer support for Monzo and then were really embedded and ingrained in product-led growth, worked closely with our great product managers. And Tom, our CEO, was very strong at this as well. And so from there, they can sort of, I guess, through osmosis, build out a lot of it. Maybe it's possible to train that. I just, like, everyone I see that comes out of product courses is very much like, go and do a bunch of A-B tests on stuff that you should be able to guess at the result already.
Yeah. I'm maybe not suggesting that you can coach intuition bit.
Yeah.
Because that passion and that attention to detail around solving the customer problem is obviously something that is very difficult to coach. But I'm talking more about just like basics around roadmap building and prioritization. Yep. And specking a new feature or something like that. I mean, I think there are some founders who don't even know how to do any of some of those things.
No, I agree.
Before, so.
And I think you're right for a while. And I think this is probably still true. Often the solution to problems is like hire a product manager. And that doesn't work if those product managers, like, you know, everyone gets into product management, but no one really understands or knows what it is or has had, whether it's the training or the experience to do that.
Yeah, I find those like sort of board meetings where something's not quite right and the sort of 60-year-olds go, oh, sales aren't good, so we need to hire a salesperson, or product's not really perfect, so we need to hire a product person. I feel like that generally doesn't work out that well, because usually there's a reason sales aren't good, which is that the product's crap, or there's a reason that the product's not good, which is your engineers are crap, or whatever it might be. So yeah, there's usually like more to it than just hire someone that's done that role for a couple of years somewhere else, even though they're probably no smarter, have no more context around the customer or whatever than the founders do themselves. So I've certainly been on the receiving end of that sort of advice when it came to like, hire an amazing, really expensive salesperson when sales weren't good, when secretly I kind of, well, not secretly, everyone knew that we just didn't really have product market fit.
Right, that's the thing. Everything comes back to product. I talk to so many people about marketing and who are struggling with figuring out the growth in marketing. And 95% of the time, the answer is you just don't have product market fit yet. You have not got a product that works.
Yeah. And you've seen that firsthand, what product market fit feels like. What was like the craziest time at Monzo where you guys were just like, oh my God, this thing is really moving so quickly. It kind of feels like the wheels are coming off.
When the BBC built an ice sculpture of a Monzo card, put it outside of our office, and for Newsnight filmed them smashing it apart, I think was just very odd, but was the moment where you suddenly realize like we've reached the mainstream. And, you know, we spent a lot of time thinking about that, like, do we have product market fit? How does that develop? How do we move from early adopters out into the mainstream? And you can obviously see it in numbers. And once we started to see people with cards out and about, that was great. But yeah, I think the point at which the BBC were doing that was both insane from like, wow, we've made it, but also insane from, oh God, what's going on? We need the wheels back on.
And presumably you had I remember the first time I saw a Monzo card. You must have constantly been reminded of the company you're working for when you saw
people. I still get excited now. Yeah. I love it. Like, I see a hot coral card down there and I still get excited.
Hey, I was early to the party. I love Monzo as well. I was a campus ambassador right in the early days.
Ah, yeah, yeah. That was another failure, actually.
Yeah, I don't know very well. Although I think I did give out a lot of cards, but I don't know how many were activated.
But I was going to ask, is the same true of your vans now? I think I saw someone post, like, tagging you that they'd seen one of your vans, and presumably you deliberately coloured them the way you have, and there's trying to bring an element of that sort of Monzo card, like, people see it and they know it straight away into what you're doing.
Yeah, 100%. To get to that sort of long-term vision, to get to the hovercraft, part of it is building out a strong consumer brand where we are recognized and trusted across the country. And when you think about our competitors, you know, actually you have a very high brand awareness for DPD, Parcel Force, Every, all of these, but trust and reputation very low. And so that's exciting for me because it shows that it's possible to build that large scale brand awareness, but we have to do it well. And so branding vans, branding drivers, branding our labels, like we have this real world physical opportunity to push our brand out there, and that's very exciting to me.
Yeah, I think that's the point, isn't it? If any company where part of your product is in the physical world or part of your operations are in the physical world, you need to leverage that. It's free advertising space. So even if it's, you know, a difficult one might be getting your employees to wear their merch all the time, but an easy one is painting your vans in a special color or painting your card in a special color. It's just free advertising space.
Yeah, people literally pay to drive vans with advertising around. I remember Deliveroo CMO once told me that this is a few years out of date now, but 10% of their consumer signups came from seeing Deliveroo riders out and about. And so they were spending a bunch of time redesigning the driver's uniform. And it's one of those things that would be really easy to just ignore and think, you know, it doesn't matter, put them in something blue, but actually drives a huge amount of actual measurable growth.
Yeah, Deliveroo was literally in my mind as we were thinking about it and talking about it. So, Tristan, you mentioned stress earlier, that you'd had 5 years of like quite high intensity. Then you took a few months to sort of recalibrate and rethink what you were going to do now. Being a builder of high growth businesses can be very intense. Is there anything that you do to try and stay relaxed or calm or steady in those moments where it feels like, you know, the world's against you?
Yeah, I got this like wrong in the early days of Monzo and learned lessons the sort of hard way on it. I spent the first year or two being all in constantly. And that meant like having Slack notifications for everything, reading Slack, like the last thing before I went to bed, being fully on it. And after some time, like basically burnt out from that and set up then some pretty strict rules on how I would interact with Monzo and my work. And that was broadly like, I'm very much about compartmentalization. So I would just separate out. And once I went home, and you know, I might go home late because I was working, but that's fine. Once I went home, I then wouldn't be looking at Slack. People could get in contact if there was an emergency through other ways. And I would just sort of switch off from that for some hours in the evening and some hours in the morning. I took pretty similar approach for Packfleet. That's sort of working less well at the moment. I had a baby about 9 months ago. And so all routine and compartmentalization has gone out the window.
Do you get Slack notifications when your baby needs feeding?
Luckily not, but we've tried to stay away from the sort of tech-enabled baby world. That is another hole I don't want to get into. But again, like making it so that I'm not constantly being notified. I don't get Slack notifications on my phone. I check it too often still, but really forcing myself to do that. And for Packfleet, it's about taking holiday. Like I just found that if I do not take regular breaks and holiday where I fully switch off, then it starts to become too much. And so now I sort of force myself to at least take a day or two every month and turn it off. Someone can always WhatsApp me. And like, luckily there are very few things that, you know, get to, you always think I need to be constantly online, but it's just not true actually. And so forcing myself to do that. But yeah, harder as a founder I've discovered than an employee.
Yeah. And just to kind of move towards the closing part of the podcast, I mean, where do you see Packfleet in 10 years? It is a noisy market. There are a few players doing similar things to Packfleet. I mean, do you think the DPDs of this world will end up acquiring players like you, or is the vision bigger than that for you?
I think there'll be a bunch of acquisition in the market. I hope they don't acquire us. I think that will be a failure. And the idea of going to work for DPD for a few years fills me with dread. And so the long-term vision is definitely to make it on our own. To do that, we need to build a merchant brand across the country where we're working with the largest brands. We need to build the consumer brand across the country. We need to be able to take that international as well and work towards that long-term hovercraft vision. That's what we're aiming for. I think if we're aiming for less, then it's very hard to make it there.
Awesome. It's very exciting. And yeah, I think we're seeing some of the fintechs outlasting some of the traditional banks and things like that. And so I'm sure that your plans are to do the same in the career space.
Yeah, I mean, I think VCs often like to think of every market as a winner-takes-all market, and there are very few actual winner-takes-all markets. I don't think we're in a winner-takes-all market, so we need to be number one, and DPD can be two or three if they want to be.
Yeah, let's hope that they settle for that. Well, Tristan, it's been really great. I mean, I genuinely feel like we could ask you so much more, and you've got so much to offer on insights. We haven't even really covered hiring and stuff, but we've covered some amazing ground around building consumer brands and having those little reminders with it in the offline world of what you do, as well as your thoughts around product owners and product managers. And it's been absolutely fascinating. So thank you for sharing so much. As you know, we like to end our episodes with our dinner party guest game. So if you were to have dinner with any three people, who would they be?
I was thinking about this. So my number one would be Elon Musk, just because I'm like so curious to like right now, like in this moment, to figure out like what the heck is going on with in his mind. I sort of broadly dislike him as a person, probably respect him as a sort of entrepreneur and builder. And so seeing him just semi destroy Twitter or save Twitter at the same time, I'm very curious. I would like to, but probably struggle to ask him the questions that I really want to ask him. Alongside him, would love to chat to Bill Gates. I think he's an example of somebody who has sort of succeeded as a capitalist billionaire and then actually gone and done great stuff with that money. And that is surprisingly rare. Everyone says, you know, I'll go and make my money and then save the world. And he's the only person actually doing that. And then probably Taylor Swift would be the third, partly because I think would be quite a fun combo to have. And partly because I'm at least in her top 0.5% Spotify listeners. So if I can get to dinner with her, then I might get a ticket to her tour and then I can die happy.
Hey, that's a great ambition. And yeah, that's a really good dinner party. If we as hosts got to pick which dinner party we were able to join, I think that might be the one, actually. So yeah, no, sounds good.
Yeah, definitely the weirdest. Well, at least the weirdest I've been to. So.
Well, thanks so much again, Tristan. It's been great to hear your riding unicorn story. And we wish you all the best with Packfleet. Can companies within London sign up? Is that...
Anyone can sign up. Anyone in the UK will deliver all of your London packages, wherever you're based.
Okay, so wherever you're based, delivering to London, you'll do.
Exactly.
Okay, good to know. Well, if anyone's listening, they should go and check out Packfleet. And yeah, thanks so much for coming on again.
No worries. Thank you so much for having me.
That's it for this week. Thanks very much for listening. To stay up to date with the latest episodes, please follow or subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. We also have a newsletter called Reading Unicorns, which is another great way to get every episode direct to your inbox. Please tell your friends about it and engage with us on social media. And we'll see you on the next episode.